Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, enrollment season is revving up into high gear. Medicare enrollment began October 15th, and open enrollment for the online insurance marketplaces commences the 1st of November. Millions of Americans are either re-enrolling for health coverage or enrolling for the first time.
Well, there are some very interesting things to note this third time around, Mark. If you qualified for subsidies to help offset the cost of coverage on the exchange last year, but failed to file your income taxes, you might not be eligible to receive those benefits this time around.
Many of those Americans who qualify for subsidies have low incomes, but they still have to fill out the IRS Form 8962, which reconciles the premium tax credits received by the individual. More than 700,000 Americans who received those subsidies either didn't file their taxes or didn't file the 8962 correctly and are at risk of losing those subsidies once they re-enroll for next year's coverage.
And 80% of Americans receive some kind of tax subsidy to offset the cost of purchasing insurance. Seems like many are just now beginning to understand the importance of filing those taxes correctly to ensure they get the maximum benefit. It's just so important to understand the requirements, even though it does seem awfully complex.
It does. And there are safeguards in place. If consumers can attest they have filled out the tax forms prior to the end of the year, they can have their subsidies restored so they're not left paying a heftier premium.
Well, there's a lot of information consumers need to have at their disposal to make the most out of the open enrollment experience. And that's why we've brought the expert on the show today, Kevin Counihan. Kevin's the CEO of healthcare.gov, the federal insurance marketplace, and he oversaw Connecticut's very successful exchange launch before taking over the nation's top position. He's got the latest information on what consumers need to know as they navigate the online marketplace this year.
Looking forward to that conversation, Margaret. Lori Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we'd love to hear from you.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Medicaid spending is up, especially in the 29 states that chose to expand Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act. According to a report recently compiled by the Kaiser Family Foundation, Medicaid spending rose by about 18% in those states that expanded coverage, while Medicaid spending rose only about 6% elsewhere. The health law gave states the option to extend Medicaid coverage to everyone with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level, or about $16,000 for an individual. In most Republican-controlled states, lawmakers refused to expand, citing fears the cost to their states would ultimately be too high. Nonetheless, some Republican-led states are moving forward with expansion. Montana plans to expand Medicaid next year, becoming the 30th state. Medicaid is financed by states and the federal government. The federal share ranges from 50% to 74%, depending on a state's per capita income. Under the health law, the federal government pays the full cost of those newly eligible enrollees through 2016. Then states gradually pick up some of the cost, but no more than 10%. States that expanded the program saw their share of costs increase by about 3.4% compared to nearly 7% in states that did not expand, leaving money on the table. Much of the growth in the non-expansion states was from increased enrollment among previously eligible parents and children. Children make up about 50% of all those covered by Medicaid programs. While Congressman Paul Ryan now sets his sights on becoming Speaker of the House, he's already stoking fires of repeal. The House voted again to repeal the Affordable Care Act, chipping away at things like the insurance mandate, requiring all Americans to purchase coverage. At a time when there are calls for more cooperation among lawmakers in Washington, this already sets the tone for a more divisive scenario regarding health reform issues. They say sitting is the new smoking in terms of potential harm to one's health, but some people who sit all day in work cubicles or long commutes gain weight while others don't. Researchers say it could be in your genes. Looking at data from the decades-long Framingham Heart Study, researchers found a link between a presence of a gene variant known as FTO and higher body mass index. The gene variant suggests we may actually inherit a propensity for sitting and sedentary behaviors that ultimately lead to higher chances of being overweight. And here's something to chew on. World Health Organization has issued a stark warning about the dangers of consuming red meat, and especially cured meats like bacon, hot dogs, and sausage. That stuff can kill you, according to the report. WHO says there's irrefutable evidence of a link between cured, processed, and red meats and cancer. The finding was based on more careful analysis of research conducted by the World Cancer Research Fund, which found a 16% increased risk of colorectal cancer associated with high and even modest consumption of red meats, even lamb and pork. The report recommends diets high in plant-based products with very limited consumption of meat. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Kevin Counihan, the First Marketplace Chief Executive Officer of healthcare.gov, the federal health insurance marketplace, where he's responsible for running the online marketplace operations and running the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. Prior to joining the Department of Health and Human Services, Mr. Counihan launched Connecticut State Exchange, Access Health CT, and before that he served as Marketing Director of Massachusetts Connector, the state insurance program launched in 2006 to support universal coverage. He earned his BA at the University of Michigan and his MBA at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. Kevin, welcome back to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, boy, what a big change has happened. You were on the show last time, and the first open enrollment was happening for the Affordable Care Act, and some tough times in Washington as they sort of work through the many challenges of the online portals. But at that time, you were having quite a different experience here in Connecticut as the CEO of Access Health CT. And that insurance exchange really has gained some traction, and some other states are using it. That in your many years of experience led the president to select you as the CEO for healthcare.gov. And there's been an enormous amount of improvements that have happened in the exchange. But could you share with our listeners what's new and improved this year and how the insurance shopping experience might be more consumer friendly?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you reflect back and think about the context that you just had provided there. And exchanges are roughly 20 years old now. And they basically follow a continuum of stages. The first stage is design and implementation. The second stage is focused much on system stability, making sure that the core functions of the system are around enrollment and eligibility and shopping and comparison and such. And the third phase is around personalization and decision support tools, essentially how to make the shopping experience more personal to the unique individual or family circumstance, and the second, to provide more tools to help make the right choice. We find ourselves at healthcare.gov solidly in that third phase. So what's new for us this year are things that focus on a more personalized, easier experience, and also more tools to help people make the right choice for themselves and their family. And so I'll just give you some examples of that. So, you know, a year ago, we reduced the number of shopping screens from 76 down to 16. And in this year, we've included some screens that ask some basic questions up front, five key questions to make sure that people keep in mind as they think about plans they're shopping for. So that can be around such things as, you know, network. It can be around, you know, physician. There are a variety of different things that are really meant to ask if people are getting the right product. The second is that we're including an out-of-pocket cost calculator, which allows people to put in some basic information that allows them to understand both their premium cost and the cost of coinsurance, deductibles, things of that sort. The third and the fourth get into such things as physician and pharmacy drug lookup. Basically, these are search tools to make sure that two key things that we know are important to enrollees, one is my doctor in the network, two, is my medication covered, that those things are searchable and easy to determine.
Well, Kevin, your focus on this phase of personalization is very important for people to realize. And when I think personalization, certainly thinking about demographics comes to mind. I know the recent estimates put the number of enrolled Americans under the Affordable Care Act at around 17.5 million, with about 8 to 9 million of those people, individuals who gained coverage on either the state or the federal exchanges. And I understand Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell would like to see at least 10 million enrolled by the end of the next open enrollment period. Can you talk about that expectation, which is being described as modest, but also give us a breakdown of the enrolled population on the exchange according to age and ethnicity, and which groups are still underrepresented among the insured population?
Well, you know, Margaret, the enrollment goal that the Secretary has established is what's known as an effectuated goal, and what that means is these are people that are paid premium at the end of the year. So these are people that are solidly up to date with respect to the premium they've paid to the insurance companies. And insurance on exchanges has traditionally served really a couple of different categories. So one are people, for example, that are self-employed, people that are between jobs, and so it acts as gap coverage, so people could be buying coverage, say, for 7 months or 4 months or things of that sort. And one of the things that we're seeing is that the unemployment rate has been dropping, which means that more people are getting work and often getting coverage through their employer, which means that that gap coverage need that they've had is no longer required. So the issue about it being a modest goal, I understand how people can interpret it that way. It's actually just the opposite, however, because the products that we're selling for are above the Medicaid level, as you know. And so actually reaching that population of the 10.5 that she refers to essentially means that we've got to get 25% of them in order then to net down to about 1 million at the end. It's a stretch goal, believe it or not. Can we get it? We can, and we're going to get it. But, you know, we've hit the low-hanging fruit.
Uh-huh.
Now we're at the high-hanging fruit.
You know, HHS estimates there are 30 million Americans who are still uninsured, and about 80% of those are eligible for some kind of subsidy to offset the cost of purchasing insurance. But clearly, one thing that hasn't changed is there are some demographic groups that are having trouble getting the message about the Affordable Care Act. And tell us a little bit about the tools that you're using at your disposal with the Latino population, Asian populations, and then that young, invincible population. Tell our listeners about your strategy reaching out to various groups within this very broad and diverse country of ours.
Well, you're absolutely right. There are obviously some key segments that need to be addressed, that always need to be addressed and then reinforced. And African-American community, I would add to that list as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found, and we found this at the state level, as you know, in Connecticut, is that these really have to be done from the community. It's local outreach. A big national top-down approach is less effective than working within the specific communities. So one of the things that we've done is, as one of the criteria for selecting our navigators and assisters and the grants that we give those for their outreach and activities, is to make sure that they have the capability and experience to work with specific ethnicities, such as you've described, and also focusing on areas that may not have been mentioned, which is in rural areas, which are a little harder to reach. Sometimes provider access is not as broad. But again, broad need and often higher levels of uninsured proportionally in a state. So our assister grant criteria specifically weighted firms that had the ability to effectively outreach to specific communities, ethnicities, and rural areas.
Well, Kevin, we've had the really great pleasure of watching navigators and assisters in action in some of our communities as they worked with individuals, many of whom hadn't had insurance for years, to get on the exchange. And certainly cost is a huge issue for people. And we've seen certainly a rise in out-of-pocket costs as consumers choose the high deductible plans in order to control those premium costs. But I understand that you're promoting an initiative at HHS that would cap the out-of-pocket health costs for families. Tell us more about this cost cap provision in the Affordable Care Act that the department is looking to enforce this year.
Well, what we've done is to assure that with respect to family protection and such, that we are protecting families from having to spend more than a specific dollar amount, which in this instance is actually specific at $6,850 in cost sharing for covered services for a single member of the household. And that the household's total cost for these services is capped at twice that amount. So what this is really intended to do is to protect families and to help assure that the laws are working as intended. Now, some of this can represent a change, and we've worked pretty effectively with employers and continue to do so to make sure that they're able to implement this change. But part of a broader point I think you're raising, which is around affordability, just in our own exchange, for example, roughly 87% of enrollees get some form of financial assistance, premium subsidies, subsidies for coinsurance, deductibles, co-pays, things of that sort. So we're very much focused on trying to make sure that people understand that they can get coverage and that can be affordable.
We're speaking today with Kevin Counihan, Marketplace CEO of healthcare.gov, the federal health insurance marketplace, where he's responsible for running the online insurance marketplace operations and running the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. Kevin, let's talk a little bit about the center. While the federal exchange provides access to coverage for a majority of Americans purchasing insurance on the marketplace, the picture still varies state to state, with some state residents having more plan choices than others. Also, a handful of state exchanges have yielded differing results for their consumers. How are the marketplace insurance plans being vetted and improved by the exchange? What kind of options are there to alleviate the coverage disparities across the country? And maybe just for our listeners, how many states are in the federal exchange versus states that are running their own?
There's a couple of things there. Health insurance plans are being overseen in two key ways. First is that they must meet specific standards for coverage and access. So it helps provide a seal of approval, sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval, so that when individuals come on the exchange, they understand that the plans offered have been vetted for specific criteria. The second is in the rate review program that has brought transparency to the market by requiring health insurance companies to publicly justify higher rate increases. And it's helped to bring the power of competition as well as the power of transparency. And we've seen some specific favorable results as a result of those initiatives. The business is very local. So, for example, choice in plans can often vary, as we talked about earlier, around density of population. So urban areas typically have more choice of health insurers and plans than rural areas do. And that's always been the case. But we've also brought new competition with respect to new issuers that have entered markets. And one of the dynamics that we're trying to do, whether you talk about the 37 states in the federal marketplace or the others that are working in the state-based marketplaces, is to try to foster a strong, competitive, but attractive business environment to make sure that insurance companies want to participate and they expand.
Kevin, I think that consumers generally seem to be getting more accustomed to purchasing their insurance through these online exchanges. But this issue of privacy still is a key concern for a lot of stakeholders in healthcare. I understand there's a new privacy initiative at healthcare.gov that is aimed at enhancing security for patient data. How do you think this privacy effort is going to provide another layer of protection for consumers?
Well, privacy is a priority of all consumers. Mm-hmm. We've recently launched a couple of new tools on our website, the first one being the Privacy Manager tool, which gives enrollees more control over the information they choose to share with us. And with this tool, consumers have the option to opt in or out of different types of third-party tools that we use in healthcare.gov for such things as data analytics, social media, and even advertising. So we're supporting all this with a do not track browser setting for our digital advertising. So if an enrollee selects do not track before visiting the site, the third-party tracking will not be loaded onto the site at all. So we've received actually very good marks from independent privacy reviewers for providing this extra level of privacy support.
Kevin, one of the factoids that I think most Americans lose sight of is that the largest source of coverage for working adults is really employer-sponsored health insurance, and more larger employers are opting for these high deductible plans for employees. And there's an emerging market as well for small business employers. And while the companies with 50 or fewer employees are not mandated to provide coverage. Those with 51 to 100 must provide coverage or pay a fine. And I understand that President Obama just signed a provision that lessens some of the requirements on those employers. How do you see the small business community navigating the coverage mandates?
Well, fundamentally, small businesses and large businesses rely on intermediaries, whether they be brokers or benefit consultants, to help them sort through their different options. And buying health insurance has traditionally been pretty complicated, whether buying as an individual or as a business. And so that navigation aspect you speak to is frequently done through those representatives. So, and we do a lot to outreach to those firms, particularly the brokers, because they're so active in the under 100 marketplace. I think the legislation you're referring to is the Protecting Affordable Coverage for Employee Act that just got passed in October.
Yep.
And what this does is to impact the way states have flexibility on whether they want to expand their definition of small group up to 100 employees, which 13 states have already done so. And we are working carefully with those states, as with the different insurance companies, to make sure that there's flexibility in place so those insurance companies have the ability to change their rates depending on whether that state expanded or contracted their definition of small group.
Well, Kevin, you were on the ground floor of universal coverage in Massachusetts back in 2006, which gives us something of a long view, almost a decade, of what happens to population health when a majority of citizens are covered. I know it's still a little bit early to gauge the impact of the Affordable Care Act on population health, but what do we see happening? Do we have any trends that we can see yet? And what really is the Massachusetts experience 10 years out in terms of changes in population health?
Well, I think one is you find that the population becomes healthier because they are able to have specific illnesses, for example, uncovered before they become catastrophic. And I'll just give you a quick example. A friend of ours was visiting from Michigan, and she was unable to afford insurance before the Affordable Care Act. And she went to the physician, and, you know, lo and behold, a certain condition was uncovered she was unaware about that potentially could have been life-threatening. That's just one small example, but I think it's a representative example of the importance of preventive care, getting people coverage, and that motivation to be healthier and to use that coverage will translate itself into more stable costs. And the reason why is when people are able to get access to preventive care and have those types of conditions uncovered before they become more catastrophic or serious, that obviously reduces what could be a very high-cost claim into a much, much more modest claim. And so, again, the people are going to be healthier. And finally, it works to create a culture of coverage. We're going to be reaching the point, and there's an assumption that they have health insurance coverage, whether they're on their parents' plan until age 26 or whether they are off on their own first job. People will assume that they need to get coverage as they assume they need to get auto insurance and other types of coverage. So all of those things are trends that we're going to see. You talk about Massachusetts, that's pretty well baked into that state. For example, their uninsured level, I think, is around 3% right now.
Right.
I think that's what we're going to see.
Kevin, the Affordable Care Act always seems to be in the midst of either battling a Supreme Court case or a presidential or congressional election. But for the average consumer, what should they be keeping their eyes on in terms of important dates that they should remember, and also for your team, what are you focusing on?
Well, key dates are November 1st, which is time when people can enroll. In fact, shopping healthcare.gov and begin actually window shopping so they can go on and see plans in their area.
Isn't that great?
It ends at the end of January. People need to get enrolled by December 15th in order to make sure they've got their coverage for January 1st. But in all of those things, our goal is to make sure that people find this experience easier and simpler. The second is they should note our call center number, which is 800-318-2596. And our call center reps are able to assist people in comparison shopping, understanding how the subsidies work, all of that stuff. They can go onto the healthcare.gov site and click on local help, and they can find the sisters. So there's a lot of different tools that we have through the healthcare.gov site, through our call center, through brokers and agents, assisters and navigators, to help people make this experience easy and simple.
We've been speaking today with Kevin Counihan, Marketplace CEO of healthcare.gov, the federal health insurance marketplace where open enrollment begins November 1st. You can learn more about their work by going to healthcare.gov or cms.gov. And Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Margaret and Mark, thank you so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump is repeating a claim that he made when he announced his presidential candidacy, claiming that under Obamacare, healthcare premiums are going up 35, 45, 55%. That's misleading. He's talking about proposed rate increases for 2016 for some plans on the individual market. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to submit any proposed rate increase above 10% for individual and small group market plans to state and federal regulators for review. There were indeed some proposed rates as high as or even higher than what Trump has cited. When we looked at his claim this summer, a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan in New Mexico that had reduced premiums for 2015 was then seeking a 65% increase for 2016. The final approved rate increase is still not available. As we said this summer, it's unclear whether the high increases Trump cites will be approved by state insurance regulators. And other plans have proposed decreases in rates or single-digit increases. The Kaiser Family Foundation analyzed the changes in premiums for major cities in 13 states and Washington, D.C. It found that the average percentage increase was 4.4% for the second lowest cost silver plan on the marketplaces from 2015 to 2016. That is an average, and there is wide variation among some of the cities. For instance, the second lowest cost silver plan is set to increase 28.7% in Minneapolis, but decrease by 10.4% in Seattle. These are proposed rate increases for the individual marketplaces, and open enrollment starts November 1st. Most Americans get their insurance coverage through work, and their premiums have been rising at low rates in recent years. For 2015, the average family plan went up 4% from last year, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Depression is extremely common among adolescents in this country, but it's often hard to differentiate between typically teen angst and a clinical condition that requires more immediate intervention. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, a population that almost ubiquitously uses texting as a form of communication.
Texting is a fantastic way to communicate with young people. So it has huge open rates and it's really fast, but it has this one weird side effect where we're the only brands that they text with. You know, you really only text with your family and friends. And so because people texted with us, they felt really comfortable. And they started sending us things that were shocking, like, I don't want to go to school tomorrow because I'm being bullied.
Nancy Lublin is CEO of Crisis Text Line, an instant texting service designed to encourage teens in crisis to reach out for help, which they receive instantly. All they have to do is text the numbers 741-741.
So if you're someone who's in pain, you text us. When messages come in with certain keywords in them, they automatically get tagged as high risk. So we don't take them chronologically. If you're at risk for suicide, you're automatically bumped up in the queue and you're like a code red.
They receive an average of 15,000 texts per day from kids experiencing everything from typical teen dilemmas, such as a fight with a boyfriend, to kids contemplating suicide.
And the supervisor would determine whether or not this person whether they have A, a plan, and B, the means, then we will trigger an active rescue.
Crisis text line, an instant, age-appropriate intervention, available free of charge and 24/7, to give kids in crisis a lifeline and lead them to help they need. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.